The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Hostess Twinkies once topped the snack cake food chain in America and beyond.
Every spaceman knows you just gotta have Hostess Twinkies along. Even space girls know it. You get a big delight in every bite. Delicious Hostess cream-filled Twinkies taste out of this world.
Like that commercial from the 1970s, the golden sponge cake with creamy filling ran past its considerable shelf life. In the early aughts, Hostess announced that it was on the brink of bankruptcy and that Twinkies, Honey Buns, and Ding Dongs were going down with it. That was before a private equity firm took over and launched what it called the sweetest comeback in the history of ever, but not without some heavy costs. Drew Harwell is a staff writer at the Washington Post and wrote what it took to save the Twinkie. We reached him via Skype. And Drew, hello. Welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So remind us of this Twinkie timeline, its ups and downs. Why and when did Hostess announce they were going to stop making Twinkies?
Yeah, so for a couple decades, they were on top of the world, and then they started to have all these sorts of labor issues where they were fighting with their workers over pensions and labor costs. And so by 2012, they filed bankruptcy for a second time, and it looked like they were going to shut down the manufacturing lines for good, stop making Twinkies and cupcakes and Ding Dongs and sort of all these iconic snacks that we had known and loved. And there was this huge public outcry. And in the following years, these private equity buyers started to see, hey, clearly there's, you know, an interest in sort of saving this iconic brand. And hey, we can actually get it for cheap too, because the company's sort of going under. So they spent a lot of money to buy the company, and now it's sort of back, and they're making the kind of snacks that they've been doing for a long time. But they've also had to, you know, sort of carve into the bottom line and make a lot of big changes to their bakeries and their workforce to sort of get it back into a normal functioning company again.
So who were these private equity companies, and are they still selling them as Hostess?
Yeah, so one of them, his name is C. Dean Metropoulos, and he's a really sort of fascinating guy. He's known as a turnaround artist, and he's become a billionaire over the years and buying up these sort of food brands that, you know, you probably have in your kitchen, but the company's sort of going under for any number of reasons. And he'll buy them, and then he'll do the sort of typical private equity thing where, you know, lots of jobs will be cut, but a lot of money will be spent on sort of upgrading the manufacturing, streamlining stuff, maybe closing some factories, but expanding production so they can make money on one side and sort of save money on the other. So he partnered up with another sort of private equity firm, and now they are still running it. It's called Hostess Brands, and it's chopped off some of the snacks it used to make, but it's still sort of making the big things that a lot of Americans know and love, like Twinkies.
How are Twinkies selling today?
Twinkies are selling a little bit better than they were, you know, a couple years ago, but it's nothing like they were selling back in, you know, the 50s, when it was this really hearty sort of post-war snack that you could throw in your lunchbox or throw in a time capsule like Bill Clinton did in 1999. You know, it was this really sort of American treat. But over the years, you know, there was a greater push toward maybe eating food that is a little seemingly more natural or more healthy or less filled with vanilla cream. And their sales sort of went down. So by 2012, they were not really selling that well. But now that there was a feeling like, hey, maybe we were taking these things for granted, they're starting to sell much better. And the new Hostess under, you know, C. Dean Metropoulos and co. have done a lot of changes to get them on more shelves. One of the things about Twinkies was, for so long, they weren't even on vending machines. They weren't even in convenience stores. This was one of the sort of outdated parts of the old business that people thought maybe cost them a lot of money. So with little changes like that, they've been able to sell in these sort of grab-and-go ways that they never were before, and they're selling a little bit better now.
We're talking about the great Twinkie turnaround with Drew Harwell. He's a staff writer at the Washington Post, and he wrote about the ups and downs of the iconic snack food, which was threatened with extinction but has since been revived and is selling fabulously. Pulling in, as you write, $650 million in revenue in 12 months, ending May 31st. No small change, but any changes in the recipe? I mean, I don't remember seeing whole grains in Twinkies. Is it the original?
No, no quinoa, no kale in the Twinkies. It's a little bit different, and they actually spent millions of dollars sort of on these company chemists to go in and do one big thing, which is extend their shelf life. You know, for so long, people had said that Twinkies would sort of last till, you know, the final days alongside cockroaches. And that was never really true. They sort of would last for about 30 days before they started turning into the kind of Twinkie you wouldn't want to eat. But they were able to sort of, through the magic of chemistry, double that shelf life. So now they're able to sell for 65 days. And, you know, there's a consumer sort of convenience to that. But the big thing on the manufacturing side is that they can expand the delivery time so they don't have to run trucks as often as they need to. They've sort of switched their delivery method from delivering straight to stores to delivering to warehouses that then sort of distribute the product like that. Little tiny tweaks like that can save them a lot of money on one side while still sort of selling the same kind of product. Some people say it tastes a little bit different, but to my palate, which is pretty unrefined, I don't really taste a difference.
Well, this is all good news for Twinkie, and those refinements sound good, but this isn't exactly a job creation story, is it?
No, it's really not. And, you know, Twinkie and Hostess sort of created this distribution method that relied on these regional bakeries that were all over the country. You'll sort of see them in some small towns where they look like thrift stores almost, and they sell old sort of baked goods for discount prices. That was a good method, but it also cost a lot of money. It was fairly inefficient because they had to staff all these regional bakeries. They had to stock them, and then they were selling them at low prices, so they weren't making as much money on the outside. So with the private equity buyers, and they've cut down on a lot of those discount stores, the big thing is that they've closed down most of the bakeries. Even the bakery in the Chicago suburb of Schiller Park, where the Twinkie was first baked, has been shut down, and 400 of those jobs were affected. Either people were laid off or moved to other bakeries. So, you know, it was hard for people to see that this company was, you know, reinvented and resurrected, and yet a lot of the production lines and industrial ovens and people who had been working making these things for decades, they were no longer needed. There's now only a few bakeries in Indiana and Kansas and Georgia that do most of the baking. But, you know, thousands of jobs have been cut over the last several years. And a lot of these were sort of union represented manufacturing jobs that had been with Hostess for their entire career. So, you know, a couple of years ago, there were 22,000 workers in more than 40 bakeries. Now it's down to about 1,000 workers in 3 bakeries. So, right. It's an incredible sort of shaving down. And, you know, the company will say, we had to get to that point to be more efficient, and we're making a product and we're selling well, so we're getting closer to being profitable. But, you know, for the people who have seen this company as an American icon for 100 years or so, that's sort of a hard pill to swallow.
Yeah, and it's still an iconic brand, however, that's selling very well. So what's next? Do we see varieties of Twinkies?
Yeah, what's next is they're going to start doing these weird kind of exclusive lines. They're doing a frozen deep-fried Twinkie that they're selling exclusively at Walmart, which is probably not a surprise. They did a year-long sort of partnership with Walmart, it seems, pinned to the state fair kind of crowd. They're also doing these sort of movie tie-ins. They're doing like a key lime slime Twinkie pinned to the Ghostbusters movie that's out this week. So there are all these sort of ideas that they're investing money in to think, how can we sort of ride this kind of pop culture wave that we've been on for a couple of years? And how can we get these people who may be eating healthy in every other meal but still want this sort of calorie-rich indulgence?
That lasts for 65 days.
Right. 65-day indulgence.
Drew, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Drew Harwell, he's staff writer at the Washington Post, and we spoke with him about his article, What It Took to Save a Twinkie. Now, you can find a link to that article and a Twinkie time lapse. Now, we cannot verify exactly the source of this, but it's a Twinkie and a tomato aging over several weeks. Find a link to look at both at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott.
I was thinking along the lines of no TV and no beer, make Homer something something.
Go crazy?
Don't mind if I do!
Homer and Marge Simpson there, hearkening back to the heyday of the couch potato. Today's TV viewers are no longer glued to their couches, leading Lawrence Scott to wonder if the vegetative viewer exists anymore. He's a writer and academic who's teaching at Arcadia University in London and wrote about the extinction of the couch potato for The New Yorker. We reached him via Skype. Lawrence, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So your students, college age, didn't know what a couch potato is. For the benefit of young listeners, what is it and where did this phrase come from?
So a couch potato, the phrase was coined in the late 70s. A man called Tom Iacino phoned up his friend and his girlfriend picked up and Tom said to the girlfriend, "Oh, is the couch potato there?" He claims to have sort of invented it spontaneously, referring to someone, and we've taken this on to mean someone who just loves slouching on the couch for hours on end, usually eating sort of ruffled potato chips, I imagine, and just watching hours and hours of television.
Sinking into the ground.
Yeah, just reaching comatose levels of TV consumption. That was sort of the vibe of it in the 90s anyway.
So I'll ask the question in the title of your article, what happened to the couch potato?
Well, that's what the strangest thing. You mentioned young listeners. I was taking some university students on a tour and we were thinking about new words and obsolete words. And I tried to explain to them what a couch potato was because one of them didn't know what it meant at all. And I thought, well, what's going on? And my book, The Four-Dimensional Human, which is out next month, it talks a lot about how digital technologies are impacting just the basic ways we live our lives. And so I'm always on the lookout for the ways in which language is changing and our expressions are changing. It also sort of hints at changes to our moral outlook. And I think with where has the couch potato gone, it has to do with this sense that we're no longer really ashamed of our lives in front of screens. There was a sense that the screen was sort of bad for you in some way. When I was young in the 80s, we were told not to sit too close to the television. Now I take my laptop into bed with me and sit sort of cuddling it. I'm about a foot away from the screen and it's in the bed. So I think there's something about the way digital devices have reprogrammed our whole relationship to watching television.
Yeah, people can watch anywhere. So with their natural habitat of couch gone, are couch potatoes now screen junkies?
Yeah, I mean, what's a better word? I think we've moved from sort of the couch potato term was always pretty much pejorative. It was also almost, it was something people were guilty about admitting that they were. It was a sense of lethargy and almost a depressive passive way to live your life when you're being a couch potato. And I think now people are still concerned and young parents are still concerned with how children are using digital devices and screens, but it's moved from a depressive mode almost to a manic mode, isn't it? It's about how do we calm people down from trying to do a million different things at once? Because let's remember that now the television has gone onto a laptop. It's sort of hidden there among many other potentially more diligent pastimes or you know, you could be doing anything on your laptop, but you could also just be watching the latest episode of Transparent or something.
Well, you're right. There is a sense that it is more active. You're doing something when you have your laptop and you're looking back and forth with your phone. You know, it's not as sluggish as the kind of moral judgment of couch potato. But does watching TV, being glued to the screen far from the family room, actually take away that judgment?
I think there's a lot less sort of embarrassment than there used to be. I think even the generation before me, they would never sort of admit to watching television during the day. Sort of daytime TV was seen as sort of a slightly embarrassing activity. And now when I'm around London on the tubes and stuff, the metro, I can see people watching television. I can see last night's soap opera and it's sort of piping up through their earbuds. And I thought, wow, I mean, I'm not really into sort of these judgment calls of you shouldn't be doing this, you shouldn't be doing that. I'm just observing a sort of a moral change that's really fascinating. And also, when we think about live television and what we call legacy television, traditional television is so much really in decline. And I think a lot of these TV shows are trying to get viewer involvement via the internet as a way of saving it as a format. You know, you always see the idea of celebrities live tweeting during their shows.
Mm-hmm.
And if they do that, viewer numbers really spike. We're always being told now to get involved, have the hashtag, you know, linked to the program. So it's all about involvement. And, you know, the old couch potato is sort of half asleep.
But how about binge watching? I mean, people do stay holed up in their houses for an entire weekend to catch up on a series. That sounds like old school couch potato behavior.
It's totally old school. And I was thinking maybe when you're asking before what has replaced it, I think the closest replacement from couch potato is the idea of Netflix binging or any sort of binge watching in that way. But the point I made in the New Yorker article, I think, was that that's sort of the couch potatoes, this big lump and noun, immobile, just lying there. And binging, even that suggests some of the jitteriness and the hyperactivity of digital life now, the sense that we're just consuming so much that it's almost not that good for us. So as I said, there's still these sort of concerns about it. It's just the mode has totally shifted and the potato metaphor no longer makes any sense in these sort of multitasking, slightly hyper times that digital technologies are sort of encouraging in us all the time.
Mm. And it does allow people to leave their home and look at their screens in public spaces. So how about it, Lawrence? Have you played with any new terms for the morphed or the updated couch potato?
What would it be? It would be like, a sort of a screen hummingbird, or you'd need something really sort of hyperactive. I don't know, something that right, the laptop leopard or something. I don't know.
Well, we'll keep working on that one.
Yeah, please do. If listeners have any suggestions, I'd love to hear them.
Well, Lawrence, thank you for speaking with us.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Lawrence Scott is a contributing writer for The New Yorker, teaches English and creative writing at Arcadia University in London. His book, The Four-Dimensional Human, is coming out in August. There's more on him and the article at wordofmouthradio.org. Many Americans regard being glued to a cell phone or an iPad screen as a sign of the end times. But in other parts of the world, small screen technology is solving problems that were once nearly impossible, like getting a pair of prescription eyeglasses in sub-Saharan Africa. Cynthia Graber has the story.
Okay. Hi, I'm Ramesh Raskar. I'm associate professor at MIT Media Lab.
Raskar heads up a team that's developing a new way to measure eyesight.
2 billion people in the world have a refractive error.
Refractive error is a term for vision problems, anything from nearsightedness to astigmatism.
And according to WHO,
the World Health Organization,
about 500 million don't have access to eye care. And many of them are blind simply because they don't have access to optometrists and ophthalmologists who can prescribe them the right pair of glasses.
There are very few optometrists in the developing world. For example, in sub-Saharan Africa, there's one for every 8 million people. And the machines used to diagnose eyesight problems are bulky and cost thousands of dollars. There are organizations out there that bring eyeglasses to the poor, but aid workers have to schlep around hundreds of pairs of glasses to try to accidentally find one that might work for someone. That's heavy, expensive, and it doesn't always work. But what if they could diagnose the problem and then provide the exact correct pair? What if they could do all this on a cell phone?
Can I try this? Can I see how it works?
I look through a small plastic eyepiece that's hooked onto a smartphone. Raskar's developed technology in the eyepiece that breaks up an image into 6 different parts and sends it to 6 different segments of my eye. But all I see through the eyepiece are some parallel lines on a cell phone screen.
And your task is to align the bottom of the green line with the top of the red line. And if you have normal vision, they would already look almost aligned.
Aligned like on top of each other?
On top of each other.
What do I need to do to try to make them line up?
As you're looking through this eyepiece, your task is to click on the keyboard of the cell phone till those lines are aligned. And the number of times you have to click indicates to us what your refractive error is.
I click a couple of times.
They're now touching each other.
Yeah.
But let's see if I can make them. Now they're on top of each other. So if I took 3 clicks to make them line up, what does that mean about my eyes?
A 3 click in this particular case would mean you have a refractive error of 0.9. It means anything beyond 1 meter is slightly blurred for you.
Interesting. Because nothing looks blurred for me.
Yikes, I thought my eyes were perfect. Raskar says maybe I needed to take a little more time before I started clicking. And anyway, he says that in the field, eye patients would do this test 8 times with the lines in different orientations to figure out just what's wrong with their eyes. And then a cell phone app computes exactly what eyeglass prescription each patient needs.
So we're already pretty close to what a high-end machine will give you.
This project couldn't have been done even, a couple of years ago.
Today's cell phones have a resolution that's down to 30 micrometers. That's smaller than the width of a human hair.
And how does that help you?
It helps us in many ways. the resolution of your cell phone is directly proportional to the accuracy we can achieve.
So, to sum up just how simple this could be in the field, an aid worker would only have to be trained to explain to patients how to use the device. Everything else is done automatically. And then an aid group could bring the right prescription glasses to the people who need them.
When I talk to people who have worked in Peace Corps or have been overseas, they have told me that simply having a pair of glasses can completely change people's livelihood.
Raskar hopes to be able to change the lives of millions of people. Right now, the cost to add on the technology is a couple of dollars per phone, but he says when it's produced on a larger scale, it could come down to just a few cents. The device is being field tested and is already in use at an eye institute in India. Raskar says it could be widely available within only 6 months.
That story originally aired on the World Vision Report and was produced by Cynthia Graber.
Word of mouth.
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 Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In 2016, public awareness of mental health issues is at an all-time high. According to the National Alliance on Mental Illness, one in five adults in the U.S., 43.8 million people, experience mental illness in a given year, and less than half get treatment. Now, imagine if those suffering did not have the words to express it. How would they describe their inner turmoil? Dr. Vint Varga works exclusively with this population, animals, specifically zoo animals. Dr. Varga's book, The Soul of All Living Creatures, and his job as an animal behavioralist depend on understanding the inner lives of animals. Vint Varga, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So how do you know when an animal is suffering from a mental illness?
What I see when I suspect an animal is suffering from some sort of mental illness is I see departures from what their normal, what I would expect their normal behavior to be in relation to the world around them, in relation to the other people, the animals around them, their habitat or environment. And that seems to be something that holds true regardless of what type of environment they're in, whether we're talking about a natural setting, a zoo setting, or in the case of a family pet, the home environment.
Well, I've been to zoos and certainly seen animals sitting there looking bored. That may be my projection. But, you know, people yelling at it, you know, mommy, mommy, look, that kind of thing, or taking photographs. Are animals more prone to mental health issues in zoos or in captivity?
I want to make sure that we differentiate between a mental health issue and an animal that doesn't have a mental health issue but is experiencing what I consider to be a normal behavioral response to the world around them. So if you give the example of an animal in a zoo that's bored or appears unhappy, there's certainly plenty of animals in zoos as well as other settings that certainly don't have any type of mental health issue but are not living an enriched or fulfilled life. Having said that, the question I think you're asking is, are animals in zoos or artificial settings living under conditions that provide them with a life that's a lot less fulfilling than an animal in their natural state? And that I have to answer as, well, it depends. It depends so much on the individual animal and the environment in which they're living in. Not just the physical environment, but the social environment, the intellectual environment. What we do know about animals, just as well as we know about people, is that they are every day looking for fulfillment and a sense of enjoyment and pleasure in their daily life.
Well, you are called into zoos in the U.S. and in Europe when animals seem to be in distress. So where do you begin? How do you start observing or treating that animal?
Well, my favorite thing to do is to appear at the zoo before I get to talk to anybody and just be with the animal and watch them, not literally with them in their habitat, sitting back and actually seeing what their daily routine is on any given morning, in the evening, when it gets to be late in the day and visitors have gone. In the middle of the day, when the visitors are coming by at a rather heavy pace, And it's sitting back and watching them that I actually gained the most amount of information. An example of an animal that I've worked with where we've worked on very much trying to enrich their world would be an ocelot by the name of Yaku. He lived in a really amazing ocelot habitat. And yet what I first encountered when I first met Yaku was that he was pretty much hiding out in his sleeping quarters many days rather than coming out into his habitat. In working with Yaku over the year, what I was able to do is manipulate the daily routine and what was going on and control his environment around him in terms of visitor load, traffic load, noises in the environment, and make his world interesting enough that without the use of anti-anxiety drugs, without changing his world to a totally different zoo, we got him to the point that most days now he will actually go onto his habitat and loves to interact with the keepers and loves to actually even interact with zoo visitors.
We're speaking with Dr. Vint Verga, who began his career as a veterinarian and is now an author and animal behavioralist who works chiefly with zoo animals suffering from depression or anxiety or other mental disorders. I know that there are a lot of pet owners whose pets are on, you know, some sort of anti-anxiety or antidepressant medication. Do you use medication in your treatment?
That certainly, as a veterinary behaviorist, I think that there are times when medication is indicated. I will tell you, in working with zoo animals, that less than 5% of the patients I work with receive any type of medication. The vast majority of patients I work with, it's a matter of trying to change the circumstances of their life so that they can find the happiness and fulfillment that we feel that they justly deserve. There's basically a very few set of circumstances or criteria that I use to decide that medication's appropriate. These are the exact same criteria that I used back when I routinely was working with family pets and behavior. And those are, number one, if there's some sort of neurochemical imbalance, just like with you or I, there are dogs, cats, elephants, zebras, leopards that do suffer from clinical depression or clinical anxiety disorders, where it's really based on their own individual neurochemistry within their brain. Another criteria that I use to help me to feel the medication would be indicated is if the problem is so severe that the animal's safety or welfare is in danger or that of others around them, either the people around them or the other animals around them. And then the third circumstance that would be probably the most likely reason would be if I feel like everything I've been trying with respect to manipulating the environment socially, physically, isn't working, and I need some help.
Is there a danger of anthropomorphizing when we're talking about animals, you know, projecting these human attributes to them and their behavior? How can you tell the difference?
Well, being a veterinarian and a scientist, what I can tell you is that coming from that community, there has been this focus traditionally for well over the past century to try to look at things objectively, where in fact we discounted the ability of animals to experience the emotions that we do as humans. And it's really in the past 20 years or so that we've really started to debunk the scientific myth that animals don't experience really the full range of emotions or a similar range of emotions that human beings do. More and more, all the scientific studies that come out show that our concern about being anthropomorphic was actually misinformed. To answer your question, sure, there's that risk, but I think that there's so much more focus, at least from the scientific community, on trying not to be anthropomorphic, that it's really only recently that we've come to realize, oops, I think we kind of blew it, and we've been missing so much.
Dr. Virga, a lot of animal rights activism has been focused on zoos, especially recently after the killing of Harambe, the gorilla at the Cincinnati Zoo. The Buenos Aires Zoo was closed for its poor treatment of animals. So as somebody who treats so many animals who are suffering in zoos, where do you stand on this argument about keeping them in captivity?
I quite honestly feel a mixture of emotions. The reason I started working with zoos, I've been in practice for nearly 30 years. And when I was a young veterinarian, I would say during the first five, maybe even 10 years of my career, I shied away from zoos well before even my career as a veterinarian, because of the haunting images that I would be presented with, not consistently by every animal, but we probably all have experienced going to a zoo and seeing an animal that touches our heart when we look at the circumstances. And we don't have to look at it analytically. We can sense on a very experiential, momentary, intuitive level that animal is living an impoverished or they're suffering, or they're just not living the type of life that we would like to have them experience. And I reached a point in my career fairly early on that I could choose to make zoos the thing that I avoided and to make them into a black and white issue as being evil and I wanted to stay away from them. Or I could work within the system to try to change the circumstances. What I found in the past 30 years is that the focus of zoos has been very honestly much more geared towards improving the quality of education, the quality of the animal's life, and the quality of visitor experience, so that what they have become in the past, if we look over an arc of the past 50 years, is 50 years ago, zoos were there for one primary purpose, entertainment. Now their primary purpose, unequivocally for any zoo that I would say I would visit that's accredited by the AZA, is their primary mission is the welfare of the animals within their walls, the conservation of animals outside of their walls, and the education of really the zoo community, but also their visitors, of what these animals need out in the natural world. It's very important that we consider one very critical thing, which is, I feel is my major mission at this point in my career, is to help people to understand that the natural world that we believe animals are experiencing around them is rapidly diminishing. Very few animals in any habitat in the world that are not living in boundaries that are very much set and limited by man.
Vint Virga, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Oh, well, thanks for having me.
Dr. Vint Virga, he is author of The Soul of All Living Creatures. He is an animal behavioralist, and you can find a link to read more about his work and also see a video. The profile came from the New York Times Magazine. The link is at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. And a warning for listeners, in this next interview, we will be discussing sexuality and sexual behaviors related to internet pornography addiction. So if there are younger listeners with you, now would be a good time to turn down the radio. Okay, well, in 1964, we know the Supreme Court Justice Potter Stewart famously said of obscenity, "I know it when I see it." You've got to wonder what he would see today when online pornography is free and so abundant that it's almost unavoidable. Some don't pay attention to this reality of the digital age. For others, online pornography is a compulsive and destructive habit. In the case of Alexander Rhodes, it was the latter. He's founder of NoFap.com, a somewhat vulgar-sounding website with an almost religious-sounding mission to help users abstain from pornography and masturbation. But rather than employ a moral angle, Alexander uses gamification and a decidedly secular approach to combating what he sees as a growing societal problem. Sridhar Papu profiled Alexander Rhodes for the New York Times. And Sridhar, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So you met this guy, Alexander. What's his story?
He was a young man who believed he was addicted to online pornography, masturbating up to 14 times a day, had worked at Google, and really sort of developed a website almost by accident by starting an online sort of chat forum and then deciding to go on his own and sort of devote his life to what he sees as a higher calling or mission.
He was young, at just 11 years old, when he first saw online pornography. Now, though, he is not doing it anymore. He's abstaining, I guess, in the language of his website.
Yeah. He hasn't looked at online pornography or masturbated since 2013. And part of that has to go back to this idea of that it was affecting not only his personal life, his interpersonal life, but also his relationship with women. And I mean, I think that's one of the interesting things when you talk to him about these things is that he's not religious and he does believe in premarital sex. And, you know, we'll talk about his sex life after he sort of quit all this.
Yeah, he's sex positive, as he identifies himself.
Yeah.
Sex addiction is not currently listed in the DSM as a disorder, but has gained a lot of acceptance as a real crippling affliction for a lot of people in recent years. Does Alexander Rhodes distinguish porn addiction from sex addiction?
I mean, for him, you know, porn addiction has to do much more on a personal basis than sex addiction, because it really involves your relationship with yourself rather than with any other person. And what you see in his conversations with other people and also the conversations that go on his website are sort of almost life lessons about not necessarily fix yourself, but improve your life. And this is one of the ways that he thinks that you can improve your life. When we talk about online pornography and sort of, you know, how prevalent it is, I mean, it's important to remember we have a generation of kids and especially young men who can access it at any time and who, as you know, some studies have seen it at earlier and earlier ages.
Yeah, and may have a kind of distorted vision of what sex looks like.
I think so, yeah. I mean, you know, it can't help but affect you and how you think it should go, how you think, you know, what's normal, what's not normal. And also, in Rose's case, sort of initially have an aversion to sort of intimate relationships.
So Alexander's website, what does it actually offer users? Is it like a 12-step program?
I mean, the site offers essentially ends up being an umbrella for young men who are trying to quit their addiction. I mean, it offers opportunities to be partnered with somebody who will act as almost an AA sponsor,
mm-hmm.
who will be there for you if you're about to, you know, quote unquote relapse. It'll offer forums for people talking about their struggles, or it'll talk about people who are in the midst of abstaining from online pornography and what they're going through.
There are also these little apps that sort of like, if you feel like you're going to relapse, you know, go here. The approach kind of gamifies treatment, including this whole concept of rebooting. Now, what is this?
I mean, I think rebooting really sort of speaks to this idea of creating a new lifestyle for yourself, and that you're literally rebooting your life from one in which you are sort of a slave to, you know, sites and, you know, certain behaviors to a different kind of life that, you know, from my perspective or from what I saw, was much more active and one that got away from a kind of sedentary, isolating experience that so many young men now sort of engage in.
But he has made this point to keep his language totally secular. And I'm wondering why. I mean, it seems like this would be a sort of natural place to refer people for religious groups who are trying to abstain or, you know, other kind of self-help groups.
I mean, there are on that site, it is an umbrella site. I mean, there are religious sections of it. But because he himself is not religious and doesn't see this as a religious issue, he really wants to stress this idea that it goes beyond religious faith or belief that somehow this violates the tenets of one's particular faith, and that it is an addiction.
My guest is Sridhar Papu of the New York Times. He wrote about Alexander Rhodes, who is behind a website that aims to help users with pornography addiction. So if you are just joining us, this conversation is about sexual behaviors that may not be suitable for younger or sensitive listeners. You said before young men. I mean, do you know the demographics of the people visiting the site?
They didn't really provide it to me, but from what I saw, I mean, they tend to skew from teens to people in their early sort of mid-20s. Basically, that generation that came up in which pornography, even in its beginning stages on the computers, suddenly became available. I mean, these are the people that you frequently see on the site.
In your profile, you write that Alexander was pretty cagey about going on the record. And do you think that's because the subject is still taboo? Is it just potentially embarrassing? What?
I mean, he's not cagey about talking about his own experience and sort of overcoming an addiction. But what you see is a very young man. I mean, he's 26 years old, who's become the face of something that is so big and so prevalent in terms of our national dialogue that he's kind of at a loss.
It's like he's ahead of a movement, but I don't think really wants to take responsibility as head of a movement, or maybe just doesn't want to be seen as that.
I think probably the latter. I mean, especially at his age. I mean, he is doing something that he actually believes in. And the question is, because you're so out there, you know, how much do you let people in? And he's struggling with that, I think. Mm.
Well, it seems like there's a little bit of tension there. Alexander quotes the sex advice columnist Dan Savage on the website, and Dan Savage himself, an advocate for pornography. Alexander says he is against legislation that would censor internet porn, but clearly believes that it can have really negative consequences on society. Is there a contradiction there, do you think?
I don't know if there's a contradiction there, but I think that tension is probably the right word. I think it sort of fits into the idea of him not viewing this as a religious issue. As he told me, it would be very easy to sort of take money from religious organizations and have him fund what he's doing, but he's chosen not to do that. You know, that inherent tension can be seen throughout, including this idea that, you know, he's against legislation. I think he sort of sees himself as someone who is willing to help people, but doesn't think that he should be telling people necessarily what to do.
Ms. Sridhar, thank you for sharing his story with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Sridhar Papu, he writes for the New York Times, and you'll find a link to his profile of Alexander Rhodes at wordofmouthradio.org. And for our last word today, geopolitics, international intrigue, and a series of gripping thrillers. Daniel Silva was a journalist based in the Middle East before he published his first novel in 1996. That book, The Unlikely Spy, hit the New York Times bestsellers list and introduced the world to Gabriel Alon, a Mossad assassin turned fine art restorer. Now 16 novels into the series, Alon is known as the Jewish James Bond and has joined the pantheon of legendary fictional spies that includes George Smiley, Jack Ryan, and Jason Bourne. Silva's deep knowledge of international intrigues and his access to intelligence have given the series an almost prophetic edge. He's described criminal acts, violent aggression, and political turmoil from the Arab Spring riots to terrorist bombings in France with uncanny precision. I'll be speaking to this master among thriller writers this Wednesday for Writers on a New England Stage. So if you're ready to take a break from convention coverage, join us to talk about how Silva created this enigmatic, conflicted hero and about his new novel, The Black Widow. Details and ticket information at wordofmouthradio.org. I'm Virginia Prescott, back tomorrow at 2 with more Word of Mouth here on NHPR.